All right, welcome back, everybody. It's the Dom and Colin podcast. I am Colin, here once again with Dom, with something very special for you guys today. Dom, first of all, how are you doing over there? Still in England for the moment.
Yeah, I'm not doing too bad. Can't speak for the country as a whole, but in a few short months, that will not be my concern anymore, as I will be leaving and departing for greener pastures. But before I do, I thought it would be good to catalogue exactly what's going on over here at the moment for the benefit of people outside who are looking on in horror and possibly ignorance as well.
Yeah, before you Brexit yourself from England, we thought it would be interesting and fun to do another episode talking through that whole Brexit situation that was a big ordeal back in summer 2016. About 2 years ago, we did a little bit of podcast coverage back then. I think we did two or three episodes talking about Brexit back then as it was going on. And today, we are here to catch up on everything that's been going on and figure out where it might be headed.
Yeah, so I would definitely recommend going back and listening to those for some of the background material. We went quite deep in the weeds there, and I don't want to repeat myself too much here. And there was also, after last year's general election, a podcast that I did with Mike Botter, a good friend of the show, who that was tangential to the wider Brexit question, I guess. But a lot of the information there, I think, is necessary for understanding what's happened since then and what might happen in the future.
All right. Yeah. So definitely do check those out. Those were a lot of fun. And as I think I've said already, a lot has been going on that I'm certainly excited to be diving into. The way this is going to work is I think like most Americans have not really been paying attention to what's been going on over in England. The big Brexit story was certainly something that I was aware of as it was going on. And of course, as we were podcasting about it, but pretty much immediately thereafter, I stopped really keeping up with all of the details. And Dom obviously is in a much different situation where you live in England and are surrounded by that kind of thing all the time. And frankly, are just much more interested in that kind of thing than European politics is not necessarily my domain.
You dabble from time to time, but
yeah. So Dom, just wanted to set it up that Dom, you're going to essentially be the expert today, and I'm going to be representing the Americans who have not really been tracking this.
Yeah, you are the casuals on the Facebook fan page in this context. And we had planned to do this at the turn of the year back in January, and channeling the spirit of Brexit, we put that off for months and months, then finally got around to it at a point where so much has happened that we now have even more to think about.
I think just a quick recap of what happened in 2016 would be a good starting point here. So in whatever terms you still think are meaningful as the story has developed, what went down in 2016? What was the Brexit vote all about, just to refresh everyone's memory?
So the cliff notes are that in June 2016, the UK voted to leave the European Union, and that result was something which people had been debating about and speculating about for a long time. The consensus, at least for a few months or a year out, was that there's going to be a vote. It's going to be closer than we would like. It's going to be a close call. But ultimately, people will vote to remain, and things will carry on mostly as they are. And that question will be put to rest and not resurface again for at least another generation or two. Instead, in what some might term a shocking blindside, the Leave campaign won, and everything since then, the majority of political discussion has been centered around the question of how and why and when we are actually going to leave. And that's going to dominate political discussion in the UK and all of the discussion outside the UK about what's happening here for a long time to come now.
So just to clarify on that last point, you guys voted to leave in 2016, but still as of this moment, there's really no plan set in place. There's no structure for how that's going to happen, or is that not correct?
So I'll say again, for all of the background material and all of the pre-2016 stuff that was going on, I would recommend listening to those earlier podcasts, which offer, I would like to think, a decent amount of detail on that. But since then, it was effectively a done deal that when we start to leave, we're going to have to trigger Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, which, without going into the details, is basically giving our 2 years' notice that we're going to leave. It sets a date in place, and then the act of doing that enables those negotiations to start for exactly what that post-Brexit arrangement is going to look like. Theresa May, as Prime Minister, so the government under Theresa May invoked Article 50 in March of 2017, and we're now about a month, or almost 18 months removed from that, and the deadline is fast approaching. So on the 29th of March 2019, we will officially leave the European Union, and there are asterisks by that, so there's going to be some kind of transitional arrangement for various things, and that there are other qualifiers, which I'm sure we'll get into, but that is the looming deadline, and that's what everything is building towards and being shaped around.
Are you optimistic that come March 29th, 2019, there will be a concrete plan that will go smoothly?
No, for reasons that we will get into, but that's what's looming over everything at the moment. And so when we talk about the timeliness of this podcast, so much has happened since the beginning of the year that had we done a podcast back then, it would probably be worth doing another one right now just to recap all of the changes that have gone on and the changes that were forced upon everybody involved in this by the fact of this approaching in the near future.
All right, so walk us through the timeline of the vote goes through up, that being the starting point, up through where we should have done the initial podcast in like January before we get into all of the recent developments.
So it's less a case of here are certain events or here are certain deadlines when things should have happened by and didn't. It's more that you have this blank canvas with this definite endpoint on it, and you know that everything needs to be completed by then. And there are certain markers along the way. There are various EU summits. There are certain just political deadlines internally in the UK where you want to have certain things in place before those or after those. And then also, there are certain points which are less well-defined, but you get the sense that if we don't sort this out by then, it's going to be much harder to sort it out afterwards. And we're going to enter into crisis mode. And logistically, there are so many things which you just need time to think through and to work out these arrangements for. And if you don't have that in place well in advance, at least some of that is going to fall through on Brexit Day, if you like. It's not a very well-defined process, and it really can't be.
So what has been going on in the last few months that has really taken this for such a big twist compared to how it was even at the beginning of 2018?
Okay, so for a long time, you had these very heated and very protracted internal and external debates over what the priorities are meant to be, what kind of Brexit are we working towards, and that still remains an open question. And there are people in every single camp who are still arguing vigorously for their own preferred form of Brexit or lack of Brexit or other preferred outcome. And that is not going to be settled. There's not going to be any unifying around any one common purpose anytime soon. But it's mostly a question of which of those voices have gained primacy in the debate and which of those are defining the government's approach, because that's the thing that everything else is going to be measured against. And the main development is that Theresa May's government has put forward a plan now for their suggested idea of what Brexit should look like. And there's some speculation that this is their opening offer, and what they actually want is going to be different from that in some important ways, but this is the classic idea of negotiation. You never show your cards face up. Your first offer is never your final one. So there's some question over what deviation from that they expect or hope for. But now that you have that on the table, that now becomes the focus point. That's now what everything else is measured against.
So the terminology I've heard thrown around is a hard Brexit versus a soft Brexit. Is that roughly what Theresa May and company are working out right now, is to what extent we want to Brexit?
So the basic terminology there is the hard Brexit camp, which is the hardcore leavers. And I guess the default option, if everything else falls through, is we just get removed from the EU entirely, and whatever arrangement we have after that looks as little like the existing one as possible. So we're not going to be in the single market for goods and services. We're not going to be in the customs union. We're not going to be subject to a lot of the same laws and regulations. And we're going to be adjacent to the EU, and we're going to have to work out some kind of deal with the EU, but we're going to do that with a lot more independence and autonomy. And that's one way of framing it, I suppose. Whereas a soft Brexit is basically trying to replicate as much of what we have now and keep that going ahead, but with as many preferred changes as we can negotiate with the hard Brexiteers and with all of the other political actors who are going to be involved in this decision.
So I imagine a lot of the decision making around this would come down to not only what the people in charge decide is like the most prudent decision to be made or whatever, but I'm guessing that the people of the United Kingdom are not just sitting quietly by as all these decisions are being made. Although if any group of people were to just sit quietly by, I guess it would be a group of British people. But how has public perception about this issue changed over time, because you mentioned at the top of the show, it was expected to not even the vote to not even go this direction. And I think it won by a few points, but there was some pretty immediate backlash after that, perhaps some regrexit, some people regretting their decision to do that. How has the kind of public discussion about this been changing over time? And how is that shaping the decisions that the Theresa Mays and so forth are making?
So in the immediate aftermath of Brexit, there was a lot of talk about, as you said, regrexit, or people who voted leave without maybe understanding the ramifications, and then being scared off and changing their minds and wanting a do-over. And that was a big talking point in the initial weeks and months, that, well, clearly people didn't understand what was going on. And now that they've seen the reality of this, then if you held the vote over, then you get a different result, which I think was always questionable at best. But you have seen this shift over time, this gradual move towards Remain. And that's not been a consistent thing. It's not been a linear pattern. It's not like if you looked at a graph of support over time, it would not just be a straight slope downwards. But it's mostly been as a reaction to various events and the general perception of how well those negotiations are going. And that's one trend that you do see very clearly, whether you're a Remainer who never wanted this in the first place, or a Leaver who is unhappy with the way that this is being implemented. Across the board, there is growing dissatisfaction with how well the negotiations are going. And if you looked at that on a graph, you would just see a precipitous drop over time. Whatever the reality of Brexit ends up being is only going to satisfy a very small percentage of people who voted to leave in the first place. And obviously, if you're a Remainer, then all of the national indignities surrounding this, all of the embarrassments, all of the just horrific blunders that the government is making in working towards this are only going to aggravate you more and more over time. So across the board, you're seeing growing discontent with this. And it's unclear what that is going to mean in actual political terms, how that's going to translate into voting behavior and so on. But that is, if you want to track national opinion, it's hard to ignore that.
So speaking of just devastating political blunders, I think it is worth reiterating for the people who may have been a little fuzzy on the details. And I think, Dom, it sounds like you know where I'm going on this. Can you quickly retell how this all came about in the first place?
Quickly, maybe not so much, but I'll be as brief as I can.
I think it's worth it. This is a fantastic kind of just political breakdown, hashtag survivor breakdown, the Lisa Welch of politics here.
Right. So the question of the UK's place in Europe was a very contentious one going back decades, even before we joined. When we eventually did get the first referendum on that, we voted to remain, and by a pretty comfortable margin. And that set the stage for our engagement with the EU going forward. But there are always these voices on the sidelines that disagreed. And as the mission statement of the EU changed and expanded and grew to include a lot more things beyond just the basics of free trade, then there were people who were uncomfortable with that, who didn't really like the EU and where it was going. That's always been a very messy relationship. And from the outside and from other countries in Europe, that's always seemed a little strange. So for a lot of European countries, there's never been that kind of Euroscepticism. Even if you disagree with what certain parts of the EU are doing or certain policies and so on, the worth of that project has never really been in question. But in the UK, it has been, and it's been an issue for a long time. And it's been an issue which has ended the careers of many, many senior politicians. The last three now Conservative prime ministers all came a cropper ultimately over Europe. And it looks like Theresa May could very well be the fourth in that trend. So it was always going to be an incredibly messy, incredibly fiery campaign. And the reason it came about in the first place was David Cameron, who was one of the victims in there, was trying to put this question to rest altogether. He had many rebellious voices in his party over the question of Europe, and he decided, both for me as a prime minister and for my party, and I guess by extension for the country as a whole, we need to settle this. We need to get this out of the way. And he never seriously gave thought to the idea that Leave might win. This was a free roll. He thought that I can be the prime minister that history records ended the European question, cemented our legacy as part of that project, and allowed a much more constructive relationship with the EU going forward, now that that's not a concern anymore. Instead, he lost the election, had to resign, and now he will go down in history as the prime minister who let that happen and enabled that to happen, and in some ways encouraged that to happen.
Right. We've seen it on Survivor with like the Zane Knights of the world, where someone is not even going to go anywhere until they just play their own way out of it. And it sounds to me like that's essentially what David Cameron did.
David Cameron is an incredibly difficult person to have any sympathy for. But you can at least see why he came to that conclusion. But the arrogance and the lack of foresight that he brought to that was so characteristic of him as a person and his entire premiership that you're really not surprised. And if you're unhappy with the result, as many people are, and as a growing number of people are, you're not stopping to think about the implications for David Cameron's legacy. You're more worried about how this is going to leave the country burning in flames.
Yeah, I wonder what David Cameron has been up to for the last couple of years. But you are right that maybe
I can answer that. This is the aggravating thing. He's been taking well-paid directorships on boards, giving speeches to other incredibly rich people, hanging out with
He's failing upwards? That doesn't sound like a rich white guy.
Yeah, it's shocking. And there was in one of the main breakdowns, one of the books that came out of the Brexit aftermath, that was by far one of the most annoying things to read, that he has essentially just glided into an effortlessly bright future for himself without any possibility that that might not be open for him. Like there was you can't fail enough to not have access to the privilege that David Cameron has and will always continue to have.
Right, sure. And I guess what I was going to say is, in general, like if you are a leader of anything, it does make sense, I think, in certain capacities to say, okay, if there is enough support for the other side, I want to find out, because that's going to greatly impact like the future of this country. But it sounds like it was not done from kind of a self-reflective point of view. It was more done in a, I think I know how this vote is definitely going to go, and I want to just hammer the opposing side even harder. And of course, it ends up getting turned on him.
Yeah, and within the EU, the gambit to hold that referendum in the first place always seemed like a weird game that he was playing. It was some question of internal Tory party politics, which was reckless at best and incredibly dangerous at worst. And even if the result had came back as expected and Remain had won, I don't think there would be the recognition of his place in history that maybe he was hoping for. I think instead it would have been marginally easier for him to get his job done, and the fact that he even wanted to do this in the first place would have made people kind of look at him askance. But instead, obviously, that's just taught his reputation, not enough for him to have to worry about that personally. But it was always an ill-conceived idea in the minds of most, and it was a particular brand of his own arrogance and narcissism that even let that happen at all.
Okay, so as the public perception has been shifting, how has your perception been shifting? Because quick recap, Dom voted to leave. He voted to Brexit. So where do you stand on that now? And how has that been changing over the years?
Yeah. And again, for the reasoning behind that, check out, I think it was the first of the two podcasts that we did about that at the time.
Racism is the reasoning behind that. Just quick cliff notes on that. So continue.
So the entirely non-racist reasons that I gave in there, I stand behind. I think a lot of the long-term issues that I brought up are still going to be issues going ahead. But one of the arguments against leave, which you saw from maybe the more undecided or the more like centrist faction, I guess, was even if there are arguments to leave, even if you think the EU is flawed in many ways, and on balance you might want to leave, the actual implementation of that is going to be difficult enough that the floor is so low, and it's lower than whatever your negative perception of the EU might be, that the pragmatic move, the smart, calculated move, is to remain. And it would be risky to endanger that. That argument was floated at the time, and I think of all the arguments that were floated back then, that has stood the test of time the best. But it's tough if you want that outcome at all. If you think there might be benefits from leaving, because what are you going to do? If you vote to stay, then you're never going to get that chance, at least not in your lifetime, probably. And yet, if you vote to leave, then it's going to be implemented by people who you don't necessarily trust to actually do that competently. So one of the things I highlighted back then was how the leave versus remain schism had really warped the traditional boundaries of politics. So on the remain side, you had all of the major parties and many business leaders and media types and so on uniting behind something in a way which they literally never could over basically anything else.
And that determined your vote, that thus Dom has to be the contrarian.
But, and on the leave side, you had this motley crew of very old school left-wing socialists within the Labour Party, along with the hyper-capitalist business types who on one fringe of the Conservative Party and in some areas of business, and then also the UKIP contingent, as well as people who really had no ideological basis but were generally skeptical of the EU for their own reasons. So on both sides, you had these weird coalitions coming together, and that was one of the things that the Leave campaign was able to make the most out of, that the idea of leaving became this kind of Rorschach test that you could project your own hopes and desires onto. That was a strength then, and it's a difficulty now, because it means that whatever form of Brexit you end up working towards will only be palatable to a small number of those people. And obviously to anyone outside that group, it might seem completely balmy. So whoever advocates for any particular form of Brexit and does it, their career is automatically over, basically, because they are the one who implemented this thing, which is guaranteed to be unpopular with a sizable majority of the population. And not only that, you have to find a form of Brexit which is palatable to so many different groups. So first of all, you have to get it through Parliament, which is much easier said than done, and we might get into some of the details there later. It has to be acceptable to the EU, which is maybe an even bigger problem. It has to go down well with the country as a whole, and as I said, that is becoming increasingly tough. It has to go down well with your own MPs to ensure your survival and your faction's survival within the party, and also with the members of your own party who, if you are deposed or challenged in any way, will determine the next leadership election. And any one of those groups is going to be hard to satisfy, and satisfying all five of those at the same time is basically impossible.
Yeah.
So you have to make a choice or a gamble about which of those you're willing to take a chance on.
Yeah, well, to quickly just go back to what sounded to me at the time to be roughly your rationale for wanting to leave and how this may play out for particularly you. It seems like, and to, something you already brought up earlier, is that when the when the UK signed on to be in the EU in like the 60s, that was something that was much different than what it has become when you guys were voting to leave, and a lot more things got woven into that over the course of the years and decades, I guess. But for me, it sounded like your perspective was, okay, now the EU is at the point where it can no longer really, we're better off not collectively having to worry about all of this stuff that it has become that we didn't even necessarily sign up for in the first place. And if we want an opportunity to make decisions in our own best interest in the future, we've essentially got to do this now. And obviously that vote ended up going your way. And you've referenced that not many people are probably going to end up at the end of this whole situation too thrilled with how this turned out. But it seems to me like you, Dom, could be one of them if what you wanted was independence for the United Kingdom to be more able to do their own thing. Do you think that that is accurate? Am I characterizing that correctly? And are you optimistic that, at least for your own very selfish reasons, this may still actually go all right?
I think at least this time you are trying to characterize me correctly, but maybe not putting it off. So my argument,
I just mischaracterize you instead. It's way easier than just getting it wrong.
Yeah. So my argument basically was that we are not at that point in all aspects yet, but you can see the trend developing over time, and the UK already occupies this very special position on the edge of Europe with this quite bespoke arrangement which no other country really has, and there are some which have their own exceptions and so on. And this is actually a debate which comes up a lot when we discuss what form Brexit should take, because the argument that a lot of the Brexiteers say is, well, we can afford to be ambitious, we can shoot for an arrangement that satisfies individual needs and interests and which gets a lot of what we think is good about the EU while removing some of the bad stuff. And the counter argument a lot of the time is that the EU is an organization based on rules. It is based on everyone working under the same common framework, and any deviation from that is a response to circumstances. It's something which comes up because they have to do that to get what they want, and getting all of the member states to agree on allowing you those concessions, which in many cases is what has to happen, is a very difficult and arduous process. The UK currently does or did have a special arrangement, but that's not something that came into place overnight or as a result of any one event. It's the result of decades of very difficult concessions back and forth on both sides, and working towards something that neither side was really that happy with ultimately, and that's how we got here. And that's also true of countries which are either in the EU but have a very different status, or countries like Norway outside the EU but which have their own history and own relationship with it. So it is strictly speaking true to say that we could get a special arrangement, but the nature of that arrangement is that you can't predict what it's going to look like or how long it's going to take to get that together or anything like that. But to go back to your attempt to describe my position back then, it's basically that right now, those concerns are increasing, and they're only going to increase over time. It will never get easier to leave the EU because the trend is towards greater integration, greater harmonization, and that being locked into place more firmly over time. And if you ever want to leave, if it ever becomes, by your own criteria, sensible to leave or to draw back in the future, drawing back at all is going to be a lot harder, and leaving certainly is going to be much harder. So if you have to do it, ideally you would have done it, I don't know, 20 years ago, but it would make sense to do it now. I think on specific issues, there's going to be a breaking point, please. So at the moment, for instance, the UK and many other countries in the EU are not in the Eurozone. We don't have to use a single currency. And that was something which was up for debate in the UK at the time. If you think back 15 years, there were many voices who were also vocal in the Brexit campaign on the Remain side, arguing that we should go in, that we should embrace that, and that is the future for the UK. And there's really no point in not doing that if we're going to be in the EU at all. That was Tony Blair's argument at the time. In retrospect, that argument was won by the Eurosceptics and conclusively won. Even on the Remain side now, no one basically was arguing that we should adopt the euro. But at the time, that would have been a basically irreversible step that I think would not have been smart and which we couldn't really walk back from. And I think if we stay in, there's going to be less freedom to deviate from the expected norm. And a lot of those tough choices will have to be confronted. And if we want to say no to any one of those, this question is going to come up again of whether we can actually remain in the EU. So I thought as a long-term vision, it made sense to leave now, replicate most of what we have already insofar as we can, but do that on a basis where we can afford to deviate down the line if things come up.
So correct me if I'm wrong again, and you know that should go without saying before every single sentence that I ever utter on this podcast. You, Dom Harvey, it sounds like, are in favor of a softer kind of Brexit or something that more replicates what you had with the EU, but you do stand by your vote to leave and still think that that was the right idea.
I think it was the right vote, and I stand by the reasons for it, but if there is a second referendum, the fact that it is a possibility is itself a big development. This was not something that was on the table even 6 months ago in the eyes
of most
people. Yeah,
we'll talk about that now. I think this is very interesting, yeah.
Okay, well, I'll say up front that if it comes down to Remain versus no deal under the current circumstances, I think I would have to vote Remain. I don't really doubt that. It's just, it would be very disappointing knowing what I think is going to be a threat in the future and knowing what could have been instead. But it's not even clear that that's going to be the question. And this is another wrinkle in public perception here. So if you ask the question, should there be a second referendum, and you track support for that over time, that has increased substantially in recent months. And there is now a decent majority in favor of having a second referendum, which you think would lead you in that direction. There are a few problems, though. The first is that there's just no time under the current arrangement. So the first referendum was planned well in advance, and even then, you had to get that through Parliament, you had to pass certain laws so that that was even possible, and also you had to get all of the logistical arrangements in place, because getting a nationwide vote, it's not an easy thing, it turns out. That by itself took many months, and it took more months than we have left before we crash out of the EU without a deal at present. And it's likely that whatever the second referendum ended up being on, that debate would take a long time to settle. So it would take even longer than the first one did. So there would have to be some kind of extension, and the EU has indicated they would allow that under those circumstances, or they would be open to that.
Do they want you back? Does the EU seem to be rooting for you guys to overturn this?
The general attitude was and remains, we don't understand why you did this in the first place, and if there was some way where we could wake up tomorrow and it never happened, that would be fine. But the act of leaving and then trying to, like, keeping one foot in the door and then walking back in, would definitely affect our future in the EU and also our ability to challenge things which we disagreed with in the future. But the general sense, both in like a business-like sense, is we want you back. And the general sentiment as Europeans is we want you back, and it's tragic that you left. Going back to this second referendum idea, there's a lot of disagreement when you dig down on what the question should be. So is it we remain versus no deal? Is it remain versus the Chequers deal, as it's called? It's based on our equivalent of Camp David, the Prime Minister's summer retreat, where all of this was negotiated. Do we want remain versus the Chequers deal? Or do we want no
that
deal
place is
versus...
called Chequers?
Just yeah.
Okay.
Like Richard Nixon's dog, I believe.
Sorry, continue.
That's the question on the question. Should it be Remain versus No Deal? Is it Remain versus Chequers? Is it No Deal versus Chequers? The other idea which has been floated is to have a three-pronged referendum. So you could have Remain versus No Deal versus Chequers. But then that brings its whole a whole different host of problems.
We have to split the vote, Don. Yes. We have to calculate it, yeah.
But that's the issue. So let's say Remain wins that three-part referendum, but No Deal plus Chequers Deal themselves have a majority of the votes. How are you meant to interpret that result democratically, right? I guess you stay in, but there would be a lot of leavers and probably some remainers who would feel that the whole thing was suspect at the very least, or illegitimate.
Well, it sounds like this theme of not very many people being happy at the end is going to be a recurring one, regardless of what direction this goes.
It's an impossible position for Theresa May and her government to be in. And like with David Cameron, these are not sympathetic figures. You don't envy their position at all. And there are some elements of certainly the Labour Party and elsewhere who they actually don't want this hot potato to be handed to them, because then they have to define their own position and handle all of these difficulties themselves, which I don't think any party is really capable of doing, and certainly not either of the two major parties in the UK at the moment.
Well, so let's track that from Theresa May's perspective in particular. How has this been going for her, and what kind of efforts is she even made? Like, I don't know how to cover the scope of the last couple of years from her, because I'm sure it's been crazy. But how is her position in all of this kind of evolved over time, and where does she seem to want to be taking this?
So for her own personal political position, you have to think back to last year and the general election that she held, and we did a podcast going over that. And that was, on one reading, the sensible thing that she had to do anyway, because she had a very narrow majority, and any Brexit deal that she had to shoot for, she was going to need more people on her side and more influence, and using that mandate, for if you like, that she had gained as a successful election-winning prime minister to marshal the votes behind that. So in that sense, knowing that she had to grapple with Brexit, it was inevitable that she was going to have to do that at some point, and there was going to be an election, whether it was then or a few years down the line. But also, just as a crude political calculation, she was 20 points ahead in the polls and wanted to bury Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party for a generation and cement her own place in history and at the top of this just landslide conservative majority. As it turns out, it didn't go so well. They fumbled the election and ended up in an even worse spot than they were to begin with. And immediately after that, you could see the stench of decay start to emanate from the government. So immediately after the election, there was a fire in a tower block in London. And I'm guessing this didn't receive any real coverage in the US, or at least you wouldn't have heard about it.
That is correct.
Yeah. But the cliff notes there is that there was this tower block that burned down, and because it didn't have the proper fireproofing materials, and there was an investigation, and some figure came out that if they'd only been willing to spend X thousand pounds on following the proper procedures and putting the right cladding in place, all of this could have been avoided, and dozens, hundreds of lives would have been saved. And this was seen as one of those events which you can dig into the details and question what the origin was, but it came to define a moment in the zeitgeist. And I think in 10 years' time, when the history books are being written and there's some 5-minute news bulletin on Theresa May or whatever, that's going to be one of the events that's featured in the loser's montage, if you like. That's in the low light reel. So as with most events like that, national opinion reverted to the norm over time, or at least began to, but that was seen as reflective of the government's overall attitude and the state that the country was in back then. And as with most governments, there's this trend where over time they lose their creativity, they lose their ability to follow their agenda, and you get the sense that they're just going through the motions and marking time until the next election. Over recent decades in the UK, going back 40 years now, the pendulum shift between the two major parties has become much slower. So you go back to the 50s and the 60s, almost every election, the control of the government was changing hands, and often it was these elections were more frequent as a response to certain events. But then when you get to Margaret Thatcher's first election, the Tories were in power for 18 years after that, followed by Labour being in place for 13 years, almost three, four terms. And then with David Cameron being elected in 2010, that shifted back in the other direction, and now we're 8 years removed from that. So you're seeing these much longer administrations start to form, and when that happens, they just lose steam after a certain length of time. And so when Theresa May comes into office after 6 years, facing the biggest national question and problem in generations. She was dead on arrival, and I think the enormity of having to grapple with Brexit masked the issue that she herself had of really not having many ideas in her own right, or not being able to articulate what it was that she wanted her government to be about. And this is a thing that has defined her career over time, that she says all the right things and she tries to give the appearance of being competent and non-ideological. But as we said a year ago after that election, when that appearance is damaged or tarnished, you're left with nothing. If you can't be the grown-up voice in the room and the sensible, safe pair of hands, what else do you have left if you don't have ideology to go back to? And many would argue that her actions are ideological if you look at the effect that they've had, and that's what matters, and that if anything, she is a radical actor. She is an extremist, but she does her best to not present herself in those terms. So she has always been an enigmatic figure, an awkward figure, someone who does not really live in the media spotlight, and her selling point was to embrace that and to say, I'm not flashy, I'm not this great performer, but I get things done. It turns out if you don't get things done, then you need to be able to justify that in the media, and if you can't, then you're running into these problems. So she is just kind of floundering around at this point, and there's no sense of direction and nothing that she can really do about it. And even if she was the complete opposite of that, even if she was the best media performer in the world and the best administrator, the best politician, the most sensible voice in the entire room, she would still have enormous difficulties coming to terms with the reality of Brexit and what that means as just an executive branch movement towards, I don't know, a certain direction in education or health policy or transport policy or really anything has just been swallowed up and subsumed by this discussion of Brexit. And in part, that's because our relationship with the EU defines almost every aspect of our political and economic life. So its tendrils are everywhere, and you can't be in any department that doesn't have to engage with that in some way. So necessarily, that's going to take over the conversation. But it also means that you can't define your own government's agenda. You can't be the visionary prime minister who improved schools for a generation of kids, or who actually saved the NHS and put it on a good track for future generations. Even if that's what you want to do, you can't really do it under these circumstances. You can't do this by yourself. This has to be part of a wider effort, and you need the best team in place that you can have to manage that. One issue here is the difference between our system, which is a parliamentary system, and the kind of system that you have in the US, where I would say the floor is much lower and the ceiling is much higher. So under your system, the high-level people in charge of various departments are appointed by the executive, and they have to be confirmed and so on, but the executive really gets to set the pace there, and they have a lot more freedom over who they want to choose. So in some cases, that's how you get Nero making his own horse consul. That's how you get Betsy DeVos and Scott Pruitt and all these other people. But in the best case, it's how you are able to find people who are qualified and know what they're doing in a certain area and make them responsible for it. So if you want to get some Nobel Prize winning economist in charge of your labor department, you can do that. Or if you want to get someone who's been in industry and science for 40 years in charge of your energy department working on renewable energy or whatever, then you can do that too. So there's a lot more variation in that. In our system, there's this, and in any parliamentary system, there's a fusion between the executive branch and the legislative branch. So these senior ministers are drawn from the ranks of your party, from your MPs. And there are ways to get around that in various countries. So we have the House of Lords, which in some cases, you are literally grandfathered in because you would just inherit a title from your grandfather and you now get a seat there for life. But in many cases, it's appointees. It's the patronage system where sometimes it's just used to reward donors or whatever. But in other times, it's there are external figures that you want involved in your government, and you can get them in by the back door by giving them a title, and then they're eligible to go into your government. And it doesn't happen often, but that's one way you can do it. But by and large, you need to find the best people from a much smaller pool. It's who the only ones you have access to are whoever had the good fortune and the money and so on to be elected as one of your MPs. And then even within that, it gets more granular. So maybe somehow among your 300 members of parliament, you do actually have someone who's been a nuclear engineer for the past 25 years. It's unlikely, given the career track that you often have to embrace to get to parliament in the first place, where there are so many lawyers and journalists and businessmen and so on, and not many people who have actually worked so-called regular jobs. But let's say that did happen somehow. maybe that person is a contender for your throne, or maybe they were on the opposite side of some important political question. In this case, maybe you're a Brexiteer and they're ready to remain, or vice versa. So there are all of these other factors determining who you get to put in charge of various briefs, and you're not going to get the kind of expertise that you can get with a direct appointment system. Does all of this
sounds
make
like
sense
a great
so far?
System. Yeah, this sounds like fantastic. I don't know how the rest of the world hasn't gotten on board with this. It seems like after having thousands of years of figuring out how to govern yourself, England's really nailed it.
Well, again, there is a debate to be had, and the upside is you're not getting Donald Trump appointing his entire family
sure.
run hard or whatever. But this forces you to reimagine what ministers have to do. So you can't get someone who has never worked in science before and have them actually be in charge of implementing energy policy, let's say. What they can do is run the Department of Energy, be the managerial figure at the top, and it's the civil servants, the actual executive branch members below them, who get to implement that. And that's all well and good up to a point, but you need those people to actually be competent managers and to embrace their brief and want to learn about it and want to have a serious interest in improving policy one way or another. And there just aren't those people in the moment, not in the Conservative Party, not in the Labour Party. The ranks of actual serious people at the top of politics right now is incredibly thin. And that's one of the depressing things about the country as a whole, that there you could count on either hand the number of people in whichever party who you would trust to run something much more simple than an entire government department. The ones who maybe are on the back benches or languishing in obscurity who might have that potential, they need to go through the cursus honorum. They need to actually climb the ladder. There's really no hope of rectifying that. And when you're facing something which demands that kind of seriousness and that ability to rise to a challenge, you need serious people. And we just don't have those at the moment. And that's one of the scarier things, which from the outside, you might not recognize instantly. But it's an issue that is not going away. And it's a scary one.
Is there any sense that there might be some kind of like groundswell in upcoming elections, like the famously recently in the U.S. Alexandria, whatever her name is, the 29-year-old winning
Colin Ocasio-Cortez, I believe.
Sorry, yes. I knew it was a hyphenated. Yeah,
you're now officially the first up against the wall when the revolution comes. By the way,
is there a sense that anything like that, some kind of massive shift in the political landscape, may go down in England amongst the youths?
Many would argue that that has already happened within the Labour Party. That's what Jeremy Corbyn and his takeover of that entire political structure represents. And that it really is a radical shift from where the party was headed, even as recently as 4 or 5 years ago. The issue there, though, is once you take control of that structure, you now have to face up to the everyday realities of organising the party and determining your official party positions and all of the administrative stuff, which took them a very long time to work out. They've settled into their rhythm now, but both within that party, you have this vicious internal struggle for control, which the Corbyn and his crew are winning resoundingly. And because so many of their party members support that, and you can hear the incredibly, almost depressingly incompetent backstory behind all of that on the part of the opposing faction in the election podcast that we did last time, but they have total control now, essentially, and they are seen as that vanguard, if you like. And there's a lot of I know among vast swathes of the American left, there was a lot of enthusiasm looking across the pond to Jeremy Corbyn.
Right.
However, in the UK, it's a little bit more complicated because the central question of our times is Remain versus Leave, and most of those people who signed up to sweep Jeremy Corbyn into office and hopefully into to government office later, as they see it, are staunch Remainers who are very pro-EU, and the Tories' Euroscepticism is one of the things they hate most about them. But Jeremy Corbyn himself has also been a staunch opponent of the EU over time, and whatever else you might say about him, he is very consistent in his policy positions. He has held the same views on basically everything from domestic policy to foreign policy for the past 30 or 40 years. It's common within that section of like the old school left to see that as a principled stand, to not really update your Rolodex of policy positions over time. You don't really need to ask him what his views are on any one question. You can just look back 10 or 15 years and find some other answer he gave or interview he did, and that's a position. And you know that hasn't changed over time. But now he finds himself at the head of this party, which is bitterly divided over Europe. The vast majority of his MPs and of his members are pro-Remain, but there's also a sizable faction who support Leave, and certainly among his voter base, the old school like white working class voters or the small town voters overwhelmingly voted to Leave. So trying to reconcile those two different factions would be difficult for anyone, but especially for Jeremy Corbyn, who embraces that ideological battle. He sees politics as a struggle for power, which it is, and there's no need or effort to compromise. And he sees that there shouldn't be. But he is one man at the head of a political party, of a shadow cabinet, and he needs the other people there to be happy as well. And everything that I said about not being able to find high caliber people in the government and in the Conservative Party at the moment applies equally, if not more so, to the Labour Party. And part of that is that with this big ideological shift, many of them who did have experience in government just aren't comfortable working for them anymore, aren't comfortable, aren't happy voting for them. Some of them have left politics to pursue other interests, such as getting rich in business or whatever. And there are just there are none of those old voices left who can be a steady hand on the tiller and guide things in the right direction. So, everybody is basically figuring things out from first principles here.
Sorry, I was going to ask, what does it entail being Jeremy Corbyn versus being Theresa May at this point? Because as you mentioned, Theresa May held the referendum thinking they were going to smack down the Labour Party, and that was a huge win for the Labour Party compared to what everyone was projecting. How has that changed things for the last whatever it was year or so?
It's a different answer for him versus the Labour Party as a whole, because the margin between the two parties and overall in Parliament is so small that any band of rebels within either party can have a big impact on the overall result of any vote, especially on Brexit.
That's what I'm asking. I'm essentially asking, is it almost better to be the leader, but not the person officially in charge? The leader of the more popular sentiment, but not the official number one guy?
I would say yes. And I don't know if you would say he represents the most popular sentiment, because in a way his radicalism has aligned him with accidentally almost with the most popular default position, which is I don't have any strong view on the EU either way. Because we voted to leave, we probably should do it, but I don't really know the specifics, or I don't want a big break with what we have already. If you spoke to most of the self-declared non-political people in the country, I think that's the most common answer you would get. And his position, which is, I support Brexit, but I can't openly state that in a strongly pro-Remain party, so I have to qualify it and wrap it up in all these abstract statements and so on, that has inadvertently landed him in that camp in a way that those people can now be happy with. So in that sense, he's doing okay for himself. The difficulty comes, as I said, with if he ever did take power, he would now be the one in Theresa May's position having to wrestle with all of those questions and...
Right.
I mean, she can't do it, he can't do it, nobody can really do it. So it really does serve them to be in that position where they are the government in waiting, and they can promise that when Brexit inevitably goes south, they can take over and pick up the pieces without having to worry about the question itself of whether Brexit should happen or not.
Right.
And it's the speculation that it would almost be in their best interest to let a no-deal Brexit happen on the worst possible terms, see the calamity that would ensue in the country as a result, which would be attributed to the ruling party, so the Conservatives in this case, and that's the easiest way for a Labour win or a Labour landslide that you're going to get.
Let Brexit be a teachable moment, essentially, and then make it clear who we should have been listening to all along.
Yeah, and they would need to find some position on what happens next. Like, do we actually remain in without any further discussion? Do we have a second referendum? Do we try to get a much softer Brexit? And that wouldn't be easy itself. And it's possible that that would almost reset the pendulum in terms of where things go back and forth, where if successive governments are dealing with their own steps in that disintegration of the country, then it could just swing back and forth until some kind of equilibrium is reached.
So it sounds like since we last spoke about Brexit a couple of years ago, Theresa May probably in a bit of a more precarious position. Jeremy Corbyn, it seems like probably a pretty big winner over these last couple of years. One name that came up a little earlier, but I definitely think we should get a little into what he's been up to since we last spoke. How about Boris Johnson? Where was he in 2016 after this vote came through? Where did he go after that? And where has he been lately? Because I've certainly seen his name trending on Twitter these in the last few weeks.
So this is a good segue back to the point that I was making before. And I got led on a tangent away from my tangent. So this is a good way to find our place again. But the issue with what I was saying in a parliamentary system where you need to draw your senior people from a very shallow pool is that when you have to balance these concerns, as Theresa May, of I was a Remainer. I voted to Remain. I supported Remain. I didn't campaign vigorously for it. So that's a point in my favor, if you like, in terms of managing the party. But I still need to make sure that whatever I make is not going to be seen as a betrayal of Brexit just through that fact alone. So her way of doing that was to stack these senior positions, and especially the senior positions concerning Brexit and foreign policy and so on, with the Brexiteers. And part of that was saying, you broke it, so you fix it. Part of it was, these are the strongest challengers to my position, so I want them inside the tent pissing out rather than vice versa. And then part of it also was to nullify any criticisms that they could make down the line if things did turn sour, whereas like, I gave you this chance and you didn't do it effectively, so you're in no place to criticize us or the way things are going at the moment. So at the time, you had Boris Johnson being named Foreign Secretary, which if there was any scintilla of hope that this was going to go well from the outset or that Theresa May's election would mark a new shift towards a better style of government, this just ended that on the spot automatically. And for anyone who knows of Boris Johnson or knows Boris Johnson, he is not the kind of person at all that you would want negotiating with foreign powers or having to ensue in any kind of diplomacy, because for as much as he is this charming vagabond in the eyes of people 10 years ago, anyone who actually had to work up close and personal with him came away horrified at the lack of self-control, the lack of discipline, and the just blasé inattentiveness to any serious considerations.
Good thing nothing like that's going on in America.
Yeah. Donald Trump, a big fan of Boris Johnson, apparently, as latest report show. But Boris Johnson was now the person, the most senior figure who was in the center of all these discussions. So already things were doomed to fail on some respect, but among the Brexiteers, they were united behind the idea that the UK should leave, but there was a lot of personal animosity between them and between other sections of the party as a whole, and none of them were really that well respected as managers. And this comes back to what I said before. None of them were people who really distinguished themselves when they were in charge of other briefs in their political histories. So now you have the entire cause of Brexit being guided by these people who just were not good at anything before and not good at this and cannot be expected to become better at it or try to become better. And these are now our official representatives. And they're dealing with their European counterparts, who in many cases are not especially inspiring themselves, but who have experience at least dealing with these issues in a way that they don't. So they find themselves completely outmatched initially. So what that means is any hope of getting the shape of a Brexit deal in place quickly evaporates. And there was a lot of back and forth over even minor details. You had frequent news stories about officials both in the UK and the EU expressing disbelief that something which should have been settled 6 months ago wasn't even on the table at this point. The preparation was so lacking. And as these stories dripped out and fed through, it really damaged the perception of both Brexit as an enterprise and of everybody involved with implementing it. And it's striking that of all of the senior Brexiteers who were appointed to those posts, none of them are still in their jobs anymore. All of them have either resigned or been demoted or moved elsewhere, and they now don't have the influence that they were meant to have, which is a good thing in many ways, but for Theresa May, what are you meant to do? Are you meant to find other even less senior or qualified Brexiteers to replace them with? Are you meant to open the door now to Remainers who would maybe be better equipped at that specific task, but who would have less legitimacy in the eyes of the Brexiteer voting MPs who you need to drive your deal through, and in the eyes of the country, there's, again, it's yet another circle that's impossible to square.
But it seemed like it was startling to me that Boris was ever taken seriously, I guess, as a political person that people would look to for guidance. Like I know we in our first podcast talked about his amazing like upbringing and being at Oxford or whatever, but it still seemed like he seemed like a figure that I still can't wrap my mind around how he ever inspired any kind of public confidence in him.
Well, he was always seen as very charming, and he had this effortless confidence that you get from being raised in that environment that tends to make you a natural leader. So when he was on these comedy panel shows, or when he was in a context where you didn't have to worry about the consequences of what he was doing, he came across as quite funny and relatable. And I know 10 years ago, I loved Boris just as this media personality. In addition to that, he's well connected. He has been in the party for a long time, done a lot of work for the party, and he's very intelligent, but it's not directed in any one real direction. So it's easy to want to invest your confidence in Boris and to believe in him, while ignoring the fact that he's never shown any basis for having that in the first place.
Okay, that makes a ton of sense. And as I've alluded to, I read recently that I believe he resigned as foreign secretary. What's the scoop on that?
He walked before he was pushed is the short version of that.
Okay. All right. And one other character kind of perhaps even along even more comical lines for me the first time around than Boris. I got to check in on my boy in purely ironic terms, of course, Nigel Farage, who was a great character to track as all this was going down. You mentioned UKIP earlier. He was the leader, I believe, of the UK Independence Party. Is that still the case? And what's Nigel just been up to? Did he just go around on a global kind of kiss my ass tour once the vote went his way?
So UKIP is like the Schrodinger's party. You never know at any given time whether Nigel Farage is or isn't the leader. It's changed a lot. He's quit. He's come back. He's quit again. But that party has been in complete disarray. And I said at the time, the most obvious and predictable outcome of the Brexit vote is that UKIP is going to disappear from the face of the planet. And they did. They've had new leaders, and Nigel Farage has been in the news a lot, and he still gets brought on for the sake of balance on the BBC to a lot of these panel shows.
We got to have an idiot on here to talk with the smart people. We need to balance it out.
In recent times, as there's this growing sense that we're headed towards either a negotiated form of Brexit that the hardcore leavers won't be happy with, or a default version of Brexit that no one else is going to be happy with, that support for UKIP is quietly creeping back up again. And that's only been in the past few months, so it's unclear how sustainable that's going to be. But before they were at 1%, 2%, they were basically non-entities. Whereas now it's starting to look like a serious threat again. And it's unclear who it's going to be a bigger threat to, although it's likely to be the Conservatives again. But Nigel Farage as a figure has just... He's there and he isn't there. It's really tough to pin him down.
Okay. Where does Meghan Markle come down on all of this?
Who cares, Colin? No one. I thought you asked where does Meghan McConnell come down, which I absolutely don't care about, but Meghan Markle either. I'm sure she's a wonderful person, but I don't know or especially care what her views on Brexit are.
Yeah, Meghan McConnell I would never bring up on this podcast, don't worry. So, regardless of Meghan Markle or Meghan McCardle, what does the commoner think about how this has been going, and what's been the impact and just kind of the public consensus about the Brexit fallout from the perspective of like the average person?
We spoke a little bit about this before, but there are a few aspects of this that I want to touch on quickly. So, the first is that there's been a lot made, especially among the Brexiteer side, about respecting the will of the people, and the people voted for Brexit, and Brexit means Brexit, apparently, although it's unclear what Brexit means, so that doesn't really help you too much. But there's, especially with the Chequers deal and the fallout from that, and there are these questions of, do the people want a second referendum, and if so, what that would look like? And that question, whenever you say, this is what the people want, you always have to question the motives behind it and what they actually mean. And one reason for that is that what they think is dependent upon what people tell them and what they hear. So there were 30-something million voters in total in the Brexit referendum. how many people among those have actually followed the details of this to any great degree? How many could tell you the different clauses of the Checkers deal or whatever? It's a tiny handful of those, and most of those are working in politics, in media, in business, in areas which have a vested interest in being up to date on all of this and in presenting it in a certain way. And so when some high profile person on the Remain side or the Leave side comes out and says the public are overwhelmingly in favor of this or against this, that becomes true in part because people like them are going out there and saying it and selling that in a certain way in the media. So this idea of what they think about X, Y, and Z is a self-fulfilling prophecy to some degree. And that's why, in light of everything that's happening now, there have been questions raised about how the BBC, for instance, handled the debate in the years and months leading up to this. So one example is that whenever they had some political panel show, for the sake of balance, if it was dealing with European issues, they would have some Eurosceptic person on the panel. And the go-to person for that was your boy, Nigel Farage, who I think has the most appearances on Question Time, the most popular. I say the most popular. No one actually likes it, but apparently people watch it. On the most viewed panel show, I think he is the most popular guest. He is the guest with the highest number of appearances of all time.
Just quickly, I know I clarified earlier, Nigel Farage is purely ironically my boy, but that story completely checks out. Like, Nigel, despite some of the gross things he is often advocating for, is a great showman on TV.
It is always very clear what role he is there to fulfill. So if you had some mild Brexiteer or someone who was generally in support of it, but under certain conditions with these qualifications, that doesn't do what they want to do in terms of having that, in air quotes, balance represented on the panel. So they instantly go for the furthest person on that extreme that they can to balance out the other three or four members of the panel who might support Remain instinctively or very explicitly. With that in mind, the vision of what Brexit might look like and the expectations that are being set for it are tailored by those figures who are the loudest, the most vocal, and in many cases, the most extreme. The counterpoint to that is on the Remain side of those panels, you have three or four different voices, none of whom are as boisterous as Nigel Farage's, and all of whom might differ on specifics. So if you have a Conservative who supports Remain and a Labour politician who supports Remain, they're not going to agree on very much. They might agree on certain aspects of Europe, but that's not going to come through in those discussions. So you have this very fragmented and yet more represented version on one side versus this much clearer, starker, and yet isolated version on the other side.
Right. It sounds the way like you're describing it to me a bit like the 2016 Republican primaries, where you had your Ted Cruz's and Marco Rubio's, and then you had Trump up there, who was just a completely different kind of character that wasn't even pretending to do the same kind of thing. And it sounds to me like that's basically Nigel on every panel show he goes on.
Essentially, yeah. I think it's become very lazy and I think very misleading and possibly a dangerous way to try and equate the 2016 election with Brexit. It's like you have these commentators on either side of the Atlantic who think, well, I don't like this and I don't like this, therefore there must be some common thread or some actual causal link between the two of them, which I don't think really holds up. And I think it distracts people from where you do see much closer analogs to Trump in Europe. So you look at what's happening in Italy right now, or Hungary and Poland have been moving towards this for a long time. Like, there are legitimately scary things going on within Europe, within countries that are in the EU, and yet those very rarely get talked about, especially I think by American commentators, because that like Atlantic exceptionalism, if you like, is all they've been reared on.
I definitely agree with that, and I think there probably are a lot of connections made that aren't super valid. Like, I guess my question would be, like, not to compare you to Trump voters, but would you essentially be the person voting for Trump because you want the tax cuts or the business benefits? And if the racism is what comes along with that, then so be it. Or is that just a misrepresentation of what the Leave side was ever about?
Well, it's not even the tax cuts or the business benefits. And that's one of the weirdest mutations that you've seen in British politics recently, is how the relationship between the major parties and business has kind of been flipped on its head. So the Conservatives traditionally were always the party of big business, and that's where a lot of their money came from. That's where their strongest supporters came from. And then the idea was that because those were the most powerful and influential people, that would trickle down and convince other people to support them as well. And yet what you've seen from especially the Tory Brexit crowd is they are savaging big business as a whole and specific industry figures and leaders who speak up against Brexit, because most senior companies and so on were heavily in the Remain camp, and their predictions of what would happen to them and to the economy as a whole were rubbished by the Brexit crowd. And so now, when you have that direct ideological conflict, maybe those Brexit supporting politicians might in other cases support policies that would be useful to those companies, but this issue of Brexit almost overrides everything else. And so you see a lot of them talking about how you can't trust these filthy capitalists in much stronger terms than even the self-proclaimed socialists like Jeremy Corbyn might do. They look mild compared to what some of these people are saying. And you also have this issue of it's hard to calibrate exactly what the effect is going to be, because for any business which is struggling, especially if they have some connection to some important connection to Europe, it's very easy for them to just sweep that under the carpet on the grounds of, oh, well, there's some uncertainty over Brexit, so of course our numbers are going to take a hit or whatever. But that only works because in many cases it's true and there is that uncertainty and they don't know exactly what's going to shake out. So that relationship has changed a bit over time. But as for the immigration issue, if you look at polling, it's become very clear that the concerns over immigration have actually dropped a lot since the Brexit vote, which doesn't align with the narrative you often hear. And so in the days and weeks after the referendum, there were lots of media reports of increased public acts of racism and so on, because certain segments who had voted for Brexit felt emboldened to express that in public. I said at the time, I thought if they had lost instead, I think you still would have seen that manifest itself, but just as anger instead of triumph.
Okay.
But either way, that's one of the findings that never really gets talked about, that concern over immigration has gone down. And in part, that's because some people are leaving. And one of the main logistical concerns now is there will be quite specialized positions. So vets, for instance, a lot of veterinary surgeons and technicians and so on, as far as I know, come from countries in the EU, and you rely on that workflow, if you like, that flow of people to keep the numbers up there. Same thing for regular nurses and doctors and the NHS as a whole. This is a big concern for them. And a lot of them are deciding, on balance, I don't know if I want to tough it out here or take the risk when I don't exactly know what's going on. So that's an issue that's going to have to be dealt with. But immigration as a whole has dropped as a concern, even as the outcome, which in theory makes that an issue again, has come to prominence. So it's I think that's another case as well where how people speak about it in public affects what other people believe. And there's a common finding in political science going back decades across many countries that it's often not the areas which directly have the most immigration that have the strongest concerns about it. It's the areas where there is some and it looks like there could be more in the future, and it's trying to put a stopgap in that the strongest concern there. Whereas for people who are already in that situation, often that exposure to immigration kind of normalizes it in their mind, and it's less of a pressing issue for them.
All right. You've done a good job talking your racism out of the podcast just through your incredible British accent. But how has life changed, if at all, on like a day-to-day basis since the vote went down for just an average person? If they didn't know that the Brexit vote even happened, if they were in a coma in the summer of 2016 and somehow just continue to live their life, would they notice much of a difference at this point, even 2 years later?
So far, most of them basically wouldn't notice any difference. And that's why there was a lot of accusations of scaremongering being hurled back and forth between both sides during the campaign and after the campaign. And there were these dire predictions from lots of people on the Remain side, which didn't come to pass immediately. And if they do in fact happen, won't come to pass for a long time. And so a lot of people, when that hasn't happened, and now a lot of very skeptical of any of those claims, regardless of their validity. And I think a lot of people expected this immediate economic collapse, and the moment the result was announced, that the pound dropped through the floor, and they thought this was the start of like this immediate crisis, which it wasn't. And I would say it was kind of silly to expect it to be, but that's the issue for anyone trying to analyze this from any perspective, is what results are you looking for and when do you expect to see them? Because currently we're scheduled to leave at the end of March next year, and there is likely to be some kind of transition period where all of this is locked into place before everything actually starts happening and our legal status changes. And so the word transition there is a little bit misleading because it implies this gradual change where over time you're going to build something up or adjust things. What actually it means is you have this deadline, which you know is going to be in place, and you try to set everything up before then. And then on that day, you are kicked out of the plane. And if you've set your parachute up correctly, great. And if you haven't, then that's on you. but that's a very sudden change that's going to click into place. And everything about life in the UK that connects with the EU in some way is going to change at once on that day. And so some of the claims about what's going to happen if we crash out with no deal, you could easily see a lot of these memorable, vivid images of day-to-day just catastrophic disruption, right? So you could have traffic piled up for miles on the south coast where the customs checks are usually done. You could have, if there's shortages of food or other specific items or whatever, these are things which will stick in the public imagination for a long time. So one good comparison might be, if you think back 40 years to the late 70s, the thing that defined that era, which was called the winter of discontent, was widespread union action. So there were constant strikes in various industries, and there was this perception that the government had lost control of the situation. They didn't know how to handle things anymore, and society as a whole was in this state of malaise and confusion. And that extended throughout all of British society. But the two most resonant images to this day are dead bodies going unburied because the gravediggers went on strike, and the rubbish collectors went on strike. So you had garbage bins piling up in public squares, and those images were flashed on the news every single night. And whenever you see some reference to it today, those are the images they use. That's the stock footage that they unearth and go back to all the time. So there are lots of these cases where things will change drastically on one specific date. And I imagine if nothing has happened by that time, in many of those cases, there's no interest for the EU or other countries to let that happen. So maybe some hasty arrangement could be put together. But it only takes one or two of those things falling through to actually cause these tremendous logistical challenges and for those to stick in the minds of the public and define not only the cause of Brexit, but the people charged with overseeing it, in this case, Theresa May's government, for a generation. And that could be the beginning of the end for them if that hasn't started already.
Okay, so yeah, if I'm understanding correctly, it sounds like not a whole lot feels different yet after the vote. Like, you wouldn't if you were in the coma, you wouldn't necessarily notice if you'd just been walking around for the last month that Britain was, or the UK, I guess, was on their way out of the EU. But it does sound like come March 29th, 2019, that if you guys haven't set your parachute up correctly, there could be some major noticeable differences, and that it's just a little too soon to tell, because while we haven't noticed anything, that it's more or less because we haven't really done anything. Is that essentially right at this point?
Yeah, that sounds about right. And what happens when Brexit pervades everything is that these otherwise unremarkable decisions or events become co-opted into this larger struggle of Remain versus Leave and the culture war more widely that surrounds that. So whenever some company announces that their new headquarters is or isn't going to be in the UK, or some big new factory or some big new construction project will or won't be in the UK, that becomes used as an example of why either these predictions of scaremongering were just that the whole time and of course we didn't have anything to worry about, or can't you see how everyone is losing confidence and getting scared and there's going to be this mass exodus, this brain drain from the UK. And so that just gets swatted back and forth. And you always want to shake people on both sides of the argument and say, well, this hasn't happened yet. The worst to come, if it is to come, is going to be a few years down the line. And so using what's happening now, either predicting that immediately there's going to be complete catastrophe, which of course there isn't, or saying, well, things are going about how they were before, so clearly nothing's going to go so badly. Neither of those is a rational perspective by your own standard. At least have some consistency there. And
yeah,
as always with these things, the gritty technical and logistical details aren't that interesting and aren't that easy to follow for most people. So the wider national debate about Brexit instead becomes conducted through these symbolic issues, which often are incredibly silly and make everybody involved look much worse. And one great example there is this whole nonsense over passports, which we've had to slog through in recent months. So there was this announcement, I don't remember exactly when, that we're going to have blue passports now. Once we leave the EU, they're going to be visually different from the standard, like, burgundy red EU passport. And that's going to be a symbol that we've taken our own step, and that's a new symbol of independence. And for a lot of older people, when I think they had blue passports many decades ago before the EU, that was like a return to some nostalgia for them.
We have blue passports, yeah, in America. I thought passports would be blue everywhere. I thought there was just a uniform passport for every country.
Well, if you're in the EU, that and you've only traveled in the EU, that's probably what you do think, because they all look roughly the same. But that whole idea, on the face of it, is silly, and people were rubbishing it, and it was seen as disdain, as an example of how this is just these old, silly Leave voters hankering for a better time, and who even cares about passports anyway? What really ignited that whole debate was when it came out that apparently it would cost £500 million to replace all of these passports and to actually put this policy into place. And so that became the totemic example of how stupid Brexit was and how delusional these Leave voters were of, can you believe these people want to spend this much money on something that's entirely symbolic, and what it's symbolic of is stupid anyway? Until it turned out that that passport contract was going to have to be done anyway, and this was just a minor cosmetic change. We're going to have to print millions of new passports over the next decade or so. We were going to have to do that regardless of what color they were, and this was just an option that we can tick to have that change. And so people who were making that claim kind of looked silly in retrospect. However, this then continued because it turns out that A, we could have changed the color anyway. We didn't need to leave in order to make that happen. There's no legal requirement for having them as a certain color. And then B, it would have been cheaper to make these passports in Europe anyway. And the contract was given, I think, to a French company. So that was used as an example of how we need to maintain those ties to Europe after Brexit. And if that had been the end of it, already it would have been an embarrassing saga for everybody involved. However, this was brought back from the dead very recently when the government said that, as an example of the benefits that Brexit has brought, but we're going to show you, not tell you, but we're going to have this every time you step into an airport now in the UK, there will be Britain only passport queues. But if you have a UK passport, you can in theory get this faster treatment through customs and passport control. And every time you enter a UK airport, if you're a frequent traveler, this will be a fairly common thing. This is one of the many benefits that Brexit has brought you. However, if you think about it for a second, it turns out that the vast majority of people coming into British airports from other countries will be British people, and therefore these queues will be longer than the standard queues, and that there's actually no reason to have those in the first place. So this entire concept is just baffling and stupid, and I wish I'd never heard anything about it. And yet, this is become the epitome of how this poisons everything, and this whole lack of seriousness around it infects everyone who's talking about it. And instead of knuckling down and sorting out the very difficult decisions and details that need to be worked through on all of this in a very short amount of time, instead the national debate just becomes defined by this just absolute arrant nonsense.
Yeah, I think England, it sounds like to me, could really use Leslie Knope to come over and color code some binders and figure out how this is going to go, or someone like that who actually wants to make sure that this goes properly, because it seems like everyone is pushing whatever angle they need to for as things pertain to Brexit to just further their own agenda for the future. And whatever the spin zone on that is going to be what it is. And that's fine. But I wanted to ask a little bit just about the media in general and the coverage of Brexit and how all that's been going, because obviously here in America, not to make any tenuous comparisons to the Trump thing, but that has been a big ordeal. Is Trump just outright doing every single thing he can to discredit the mainstream media that doesn't just print constant Trump propaganda? And is anything like that, or any Russian hacking or anything along those lines, happening in England?
So I don't know if the name Cambridge Analytica means anything to you.
It sure does.
Yes. So that company supposedly was also heavily involved with one of the Leave campaigns. And if you want to understand why there are multiple, again, go back and listen to our previous editions. But there have been a lot of those like external claims, if you like, that questioning the legitimacy of the result itself. So one of the controversies that's come out recently is that Vote Leave apparently broke the spending limits in some way during the campaign. And you can, I mean, it's unclear if that actually had any impact at all on the final result, but the idea that they broke the rules and therefore everything that came afterwards is illegitimate, you can see the echoes of that in a lot of the, I would say, paranoia around the like the Russian hacking stuff over in the US, where there's been nothing concrete proved. I mean,
zero indictments, nothing substantial at all, Dom.
No, I'm saying clearly there are indictments and clearly there's corruption on a massive scale, which you expected from Donald Trump. I mean, nothing about that is remotely surprising whatsoever. But in terms of this is how from A to B to C, this affected the result of the election campaign, nothing about that is substantial yet. And I think there are people
right.
who...
Okay.
And if you want to draw those comparisons, one thing you see in both cases is people clinging to this hope of a smoking gun, that in your case, that Robert Mueller is going to uncover some bombshell that's going to bring down the entire Trump White House and the GOP is going to be forced to impeach him. And in our case, that there is going to be some legal loophole to get out of it, or that the Leave campaign will be found to have colluded in some way or broken some rule, and that can render the entire thing off limits.
Yeah. Oh, just to be clear, I don't want to put anything out there too definitive. Like Dom mentioned, nothing's been proven. I'm sure everything, all just a witch hunt, and everything's above board for sure.
No, but you're not saying what I'm saying. I think that, like, clearly we know there's something incredibly nefarious going on.
I do see what you're saying. Where we can't demonstrably say because this action was taken that then gave us this result and that's how Trump won. I agree. There's no hard dots to connect yet as things stand right now. But I'm asking, I guess, if there's even suspicion of things like that. And it sounds like Cambridge Analytica delivering once again.
Yeah, there is definitely a lot of suspicion around it. But to go on too long a tangent quickly, but this is my primary concern about what's going on politically in the US right now, that coming into the midterms, the Democrats will double down on this Russian hacking stuff, and that will be the focus of their campaign. When it turns out that most voters who aren't that politically invested and who don't have a direct partisan interest in Donald Trump being taken down don't care about that as much. Like that is not, if you look at any poll of what issues people most care about, that comes so far down the list. And their major concerns are the ones that they've always been. It's the economy. It's healthcare. It's everything else, which are much more, or should be much more, fertile grounds for you anyway. And just endlessly going on this this Russian hacking threat is not going to get you anywhere. And it's the one way that I think they can just find a way to punt away what should be an easy election for them, an easy election
right.
cycle. And it terrifies me that they will somehow be so incompetent that they find the only losing line and they manage to take it.
I think, Dom, if I know the Democratic Party, I think your concerns are valid about that potentially being an issue. I'm not sure how many people have more like tactical blunders, like how many political organizations have more just strategic tactical blunders on their resume than the Democratic Party in the U.S.
It is truly depressing. But to answer your question about the media, there is definitely this endless vigil watching out for any signs that Brexit is going to be derailed in some way or even just softened to any reasonable degree. So Theresa May, for instance, initially when it seemed like she was going to pursue a very hard Brexit, as hard a Brexit as possible, much harder than most mainstream commentators or even politicians in her own party expected her to pursue, there was a very loud faction among the Brexit supporting press just hailing her as some heroine sent from on high to deliver Brexit to us, and she was this goddess, or G-Oddess if you prefer, who was going to swat away the treasonous Remain voters and blaze a path towards a brighter future for the UK. And now, when, as it turns out, she does have to compromise, and maybe that was her bargaining position the whole time, to move us closer to something more towards the middle, well, now you have the mainstream, supposedly respectable voice of the Tory press calling her a traitor, calling her treasonous. That whenever any, like, that there's some legal decision around it. So when it was ruled fairly soon after Brexit that whatever the eventual deal was, Parliament would have to vote on it, which makes sense, you would think, that you're not just going to have the government ramming through a Brexit deal with no reference to Parliament. But that, among a lot of people, was seen as a great betrayal. This was judges plotting to overturn Brexit, and these were enemies of the people, enemies of the state, who had to be challenged in some way. And that discourse became very heated, bordering on violent at many points. And that, I think that's only going to get worse over time if it seems like we either get close to a no-deal Brexit, which is what some of them want, and then suddenly we're rescued from it somehow, or when this deal does go through and it's going to be a lot more moderate and certainly a lot more uninspiring than any of them hoped at the time.
Well, as far as I'm understanding, it sounds to me at this point like it's still obviously very unclear how this is all going to play out come the end of March of next year, which I guess, I mean, that's less than 8 months from now that this is all going to be going down. And it sounds like there are a ton of different timelines, essentially, for how all of this could play out. I think let's talk through in a little more detail those timelines. And I guess I'll start with, what do you think is the most likely timeline? Like, are we looking more at a hard Brexit if the people in charge get what they want and can get their act together? Or are we looking at something a lot, basically, as you described earlier, like our own private version of what we had going with the EU? Or as far as I think this might be my pick at this point, is we get to approximately March 12th of 2019 and still have no real idea what's going to happen.
That is increasingly likely, yeah. And if you'd asked me 6 months ago, I think my answer for the most likely outcome would be quite different from what it is now. So whereas then I would not have considered no deal to be realistically on the table. I guess it was always on the table by virtue of being the default, if nothing else comes together. But now it seems like that is seriously something that could and might happen. And you see the expectations management surrounding that really kicked into overdrive now, where before, whenever these claims were made about what would happen if we didn't get a deal, their argument was, well, no one's arguing for a no-deal Brexit. We're going to have some kind of deal, and maybe we disagree on the terms of what that should be, but there's going to be some kind of deal. So all of this about what's going to happen if we crash out and nothing's in place is just scaremongering from the Remainers. Whereas now, a lot of what you hear is, well, we are preparing for no deal. We should have been preparing for it for much longer if only you had let us do that properly. And this is what people voted for all along. They want to come out of the EU, and Brexit means Brexit, and no deal is a default and a reasonable option now. So you see how the framing of it has radically shifted over time there.
Well, let's get into what no deal would look like potentially. Like, can you, I guess, just quickly explain what the idea of no deal would even mean for the UK and their relationship with the EU going forward? Because I think for me as an American who has not paid a whole lot of attention to this, I obviously understand what the concept of no deal means. We can't come to terms that we all agree on, but we've still voted to leave the EU when now we're getting tossed out of the plane and we don't even have the beginnings of a parachute. So in actual terms, what would no deal entail as far as moving forward?
So what it would mean is this entire complicated web of legal arrangements and everything else that the UK is involved in with Europe would just cease to exist. We would be cast out of that all at once. And as I said, the implications of that are too numerous to really consider. And I think possibly too momentous for anyone to actually grasp in its totality. And that's one reason why nobody actually has a complete picture of what would happen after any form of Brexit, because you have these very specialized areas where if you've been working in, agriculture for 20 years in some specific part of that, maybe there's some very obscure EU law that is central to everything that you do on a day-to-day basis, but which nobody else outside of your niche in your larger niche has any reason to know or care about. And that can be replicated hundreds or thousands of times across all sectors of the economy. And then also you have the big picture questions, which are hard to answer themselves. But there are certain high-profile consequences, which I spoke about before. So customs, for instance. You would need to have an infrastructure in place to handle all of the traffic coming from France and other places through the Channel Tunnel, through the south of the UK. And currently, that's fine. You don't need to put these complicated checks in place because as members of the EU, the UK and France are under the same arrangements, and there's no worry about what that would entail. If we come out of the EU with no customs union, no arrangement, no anything else, all of that changes. And we would have to find some way to deal with this massive volume of goods and services coming through. And the infrastructure just isn't there. And I don't mean that currently it isn't there, but it could be. I mean, it literally isn't there. It's unclear how anybody would fix that, even with very up-to-date technology. The other big picture example that comes to mind is that because we've been in the EU for so long, and a lot of these arrangements are have been in place for a long time, so much of our production in our economy has been optimized around the assumptions that we can make around that. So on having certain access to different types of goods and knowing that part A is going to come from this country in the EU and so on. And most of the supply chains for a lot of major businesses are built on this just-in-time basis, where often if you're trying to manufacture something, whether it's like a car or some like complicated equipment, or just something as simple as a sandwich in a bakery, a lot of the time you're getting the necessary components for that, sometimes that morning. You're making whatever it is you make, you ship it out that evening, sometimes back across the channel to the EU, sometimes to elsewhere in the UK. You're only able to do that because you have this frictionless movement of the goods that you need, and you're able to not have to stockpile thousands of different parts because you know you can get it ideally that morning from your usual supplier, and if not, there's going to be some other backup option. We don't know if that's going to be true after we leave, and a lot of companies which now are sustainable only because they're able to do that will have to radically rethink or maybe shut down altogether, because that just won't work in the same easy way anymore. And it's like we said before, no one really has any incentive to paint an accurate picture of what it's going to be like, even if they know, which they don't. So the government, for instance, has come under a lot of attack recently for hiding its plans for a no-deal Brexit. And the parts of that which have leaked are not reassuring, to say the least. But there's also the argument that the government has an incentive to make that look worse than it could be and to exaggerate how bad it would be in order to increase support for their preferred deal and to try and scare people into getting into line. On the other hand, if they successfully do that, if they successfully make people think that this is going to be a catastrophe, which it very well could be, and they fail to avoid that, then they look even worse in retrospect. So that's a gamble that they're taking as well. But that goes the other way too. So when they're negotiating with the EU, the government has an incentive to make it seem like they are willing to walk away from the table and to embrace no deal if that's what it comes down to in order to extract better terms and better concessions. So if they're doing that and at the same time trying to say that no deal would be a catastrophe and of course we have to avoid that to get the deal that we eventually negotiate through, then there's a clear contradiction there. So it's a very difficult thing to figure out because nobody has the full story. Many of the principal actors involved are not putting the due diligence in to make sure they have all the information that they need to have. And then none of them, even if they do have it, have an incentive to frame that to the public at large in an accurate way. So it's as messy as it seems like based on how I'm conveying it.
Yeah, this seems like the next game that should be coming up on Social Strategy Sunday, this UK Brexit solving situation. This seems like the most exciting reality show I've heard about in a long time. I think there are a big missed opportunity here not filming it in that capacity. But in you said earlier, originally you didn't think no deal was even a possibility for a long time. And I think you may have said, I think like even up to 6 months ago, you would have thought that was still off the table. At this hour in the early August 2018, how likely do you think that is now as a possibility, if you could put a rough number on it?
It's so hard to assign equity or whatever, but
right. That's what I'm asking, essentially.
Yeah. So in terms of the possible outcomes, there's that. There's some deal getting through quite late because people are too scared to hold the line. They don't want to be held responsible for plunging us into no deal. And I imagine that would have to involve a lot of soft Remain Labour MPs breaking ranks from their official party line and just voting some deal through, even if they're not happy with it. And the thought of having to side with Theresa May over their own party it repulses them. They might just see that as the pragmatic move that they have to make. We can get onto that later. And then also, there's another outcome, which is that nothing really comes into place, but the EU doesn't want that to happen either. And so this transition arrangement becomes the first of many transition arrangements which keep becoming renewed. And then the entire question of what Brexit might look like is kind of kicked into touch for the short term. And when that becomes bogged down, it's hard to see how any momentum could really arise over some new deal without a radical shift in government, first of all. So one of the issues we highlighted before was there was a need to hold the election that we had last year, not just because Theresa May wanted to be the master of all she surveys and have a stonking great majority, but also because, hypothetically, let's say you're in the middle of these negotiations and that period is 2 years longer now if there's a transition arrangement, and then there's a change of government. And now you have someone, you have a government under Jeremy Corbyn with a completely different view of what that deal should look like, and that scuppers potentially any deal that was on the table beforehand. And all of these concerns we raise now about not having the time to work any of that through now come up again, because you essentially start from day zero if they want to change direction.
Can I just put a prediction out there that I don't think is going to surprise too many people, and I'll try to be quick about this, but I think no deal is getting the winner edit. That's my winner pick at this point, is no deal. It started as the underdog that no one saw coming, and now I think no deal is going nowhere but up.
Yeah, I'm not sure who the compelling losing finalist is at this stage, but they're really, it's the best of the worst, frankly, I think, when you're talking about the other options.
Yeah, hard Brexit is the compelling losing finalist, and soft Brexit gets the bubble because they knew that would win if too many people took it seriously.
Right. So that's the undefined third option, where nothing really happens in the short term, and it's unclear what's going to happen in the long term, and the entire question is just quietly swept under the rug. And that would definitely be seen as a betrayal by Brexit voters, but I think that is... it could actually be the most likely outcome, that however many years down the line, we just arrive in the default position that we're in at the moment under some new legal framework of we want just that. That ends up seeming like the most pragmatic option, the least worst of anything that's on the table.
Mm-hmm. I could definitely see you guys going for some middle of the road, but in an edgier way than normal, like just kind of being in limbo somehow for like 15 straight years, I think is on the table as one of the outcomes as well. I think like there's going to be some kind of someone's going to be David Cameroning themselves here. And I think you're going to collectively do that as a country in some capacity.
And how that plays out matters a lot too, because if we do actually leave and then have to be readmitted instead of just canceling our invocation of Article 50 or whatever, which again is unclear if anyone can do that because it's never been tested before. But if we leave and then are coming back with our tail between our legs, then they will drive a hard bargain for readmission, even if all of the member states would let us back in, which is something that would have to be agreed. And some of them might want to put certain terms on that in order to get other concessions that they want in other areas. So some small country might kick up a fuss because there's something else that they're not getting their way on, and they might think this is a good quid pro quo, that if they get A, then we'll give you B. And I imagine the bigger countries would push back on that, and there would be some internal horse trading or whatever. But even that as a prospect is concerning, that if we do get readmitted, it's not going to be on the bespoke special terms that we have at the moment. It's going to be you are joining the euro, you are signing up to every single provision of every law that we care about, and you're not going to have any real say over what matters beyond the mathematical possibilities provided to you by your vote, and whatever influence we had before, which one of the arguments for coming out was we basically don't have any as it is, any hope of that is going to be extinguished.
Right. And who does that like, I understand what you're saying, but it seems like when you vote to leave, Dom Harvey, you can reasonably anticipate that while leaving in theory may be the best idea, this is England we're talking about. We're going to delay and delay, and no one's going to take ownership, and we're going to mess this up somehow. And I don't think it would have surprised you a couple of years ago. Like, I'm sure plenty of the twists and turns along the way would have surprised you, but I don't think you would have been taken aback at all to learn that no real progress had been made even to this point. And when you understand that in some capacity going back to the EU with your tail between your legs, as you just laid out, is an increasingly realistic possibility after this attempt at essential, what's going to essentially just be viewed as an attempt, a failed attempt at defiance, that still sounds better to you. Like, you're still happy to have voted to leave.
A lot of that is the demands being forced on us by, firstly, the timing of it, and then secondly, the how that's become worse because of the incompetence at a high level. So if they'd come out and said on day one, we are pushing for a hard Brexit, where we're coming out of the single market, we're coming out of the customs union, we're leaving a lot of these arrangements, we're going to forge our own path, and we're going to set out clearly in the short term how we expect that to happen, that would not be the type of Brexit that I would have wanted. But I think it would have been a lot more effective than just the complete inaction that we're seeing currently. And it was unclear at the time, I think, whether that inaction was more likely to happen than either a strong push for a hard Brexit or a strong push for a soft Brexit. So a lot of the logistical issues that we potentially will have to grapple with very quickly and very messily would have been avoided even under a hard Brexit, I think, had preparations started properly and in earnest 2 years ago now. But since that didn't happen, you almost get the worst of every world now, where regardless of what you do, it's going to be at best a suboptimal version of what you wanted initially.
Okay, so I'm full disclosure. The reason I've a few times now probably have come at you and your vote is I don't know a whole lot, obviously, about what went into the vote myself. I know what we talked about the first time, but as far as like having any of the ramifications land on me, obviously that's not going to happen. I'm not in England. But pretty much every other person our age that is from England that I've heard from that would be affected by this was someone who voted to remain. And I really, not to make unfair comparisons to the US again, but I think if you look at the age demographic breakdowns in 2016 and how they line up with the left versus being on the left versus being on the right, and where I line up with that, I would imagine that I would be a hard pro Remain person if I was there in England and understood the full ramifications of this. And I do feel compelled to, despite not really knowing many of the details myself, give the benefit of the doubt to those people, or at least push you harder on it. Because every other person that I've heard from, not even regardless of age, that I've heard from in England was someone who voted to remain.
Well, while you also have other cleavages that cut across that, so race, class, gender are all big ones. So, in macro, I think that the vast majority of young people would have voted against Trump. But if you break that down, like, I don't know that young independent voters who are white and well off and would have broke the same way. I don't know if you break that down by gender, if that holds up as well. So I think it's a lot more granular than you're letting on. But certainly, yeah, in the UK, you can see it. If you break it down just by age, it's pretty stark how that changes as you get older. It's something like with every 10 years you add to the average voter, their likelihood to have voted remain instead of leave decreases by a certain amount or whatever. If you put it in those terms, it does seem pretty strong. But I think in general, there's this narrative that's taken hold where it's always the young voters who are at the forefront of progress, and it's the older generations pushing back against that, which depending on where you look certainly looks like the case a lot of the time. But you think back to the big political and cultural movements of the late 60s, for instance, certainly in the US, it has become an accepted truth that it was young people who were out there protesting against Vietnam, protesting against the excesses of the government and so on, when in reality it was younger people who were more likely to support the military efforts, and it was only the people who would have opposed Nixon anyway, the smaller fraction of them who were on the left at the time or who were pushing back against that authority at the time, who were the most high profile figures, and they were able to be caricatured by the right as the unacceptable face of the opposition then. So if you turned on the news, it was always these hippies who had no respect for traditional morals, no respect for society, who were leading the forefront against that, when in reality their numbers were quite low, and it was, if anything, more of the younger voters who supported the war, who supported a tougher stance on a lot of those issues. And it was the older voters who had direct memories of World War II and of the atrocities of war who were more skeptical about the need for that. So that's one
that's really interesting. I had no idea about that.
So that's one specific example, and it doesn't carry across in the exact way. But I think just having this default policy of whatever the young people vote for must be correct, I think is going to lead you down a dangerous path sometimes.
No, I completely agree. And I was just waiting for an opportunity to jump in and clarify. I've heard from enough people that despite not knowing the details, I'm just a Remain guy. I think Dom makes a ton of good points about leaving and the just UK independence in general. But I did just want to put out there that I did at least feel compelled to go at it a little harder from that angle, just based on the sheer number of people that I've heard from that are hard Remain people. And when I tell them that a guy I know voted to leave, they're like horrified.
Sure, but are they hard Remain because they have they've always had this burning passion for a certain stance on the EU? Or is it because, kind of like you were alluding to, that is seen as the default informed position, and that's just where they come down in that question now?
I don't know. I don't know what their reasons are for it, but it does seem to be a recurring trend, and that is why I have felt like it was at least worth asking more about things from that perspective. So sorry if you feel attacked at any point, although I feel attacked because I'm attacking you.
I guess this is the point, to ask the questions that need to be asked and to dive into that. But it's interesting that I think compared to some of those people, in many questions or in many topics, I might be like or further extreme in some position than they are. And yet you kind of flip that around. And now, because I don't fit completely into that bundle of positions that maybe they support, that's seen as this just contradiction that's hard to move past.
No, I just feel like I want to put out there that I am completely biased in this issue and why I'm pushing back so hard on it. And I feel like, if we were talking about anything else where I already agreed with you, or most of the people that I heard from agreed with you, I would not feel nearly as compelled to take it from the opposite side.
Sure. There is the alternate hope here that lack of anything turns into something that generally resembles what we have now under some whatever fudging has to be done to make that happen, which was the outcome that many of us who wanted all along, that if we do have to leave, that's what it's generally going to look like. So it's possible that the default turns into this other default on the opposite end, which is what we would have hoped for from any actual deal, but even if that doesn't come to pass.
Well, okay, so realistically, what does the best case scenario look like from here for you?
So what metric are you asking that on? Like best by whose standards?
By your standards. What is the best timeline that could realistically happen? Not people just magically getting it together, but based on what you have seen so far, how would you hope this could progress from here in the most optimal way?
So the question of what's realistic is made more frustrating in a way by the fact that this weird form of hard Brexit that May was pushing towards and then is walking back in this staggered way, that's much harder to engineer than a simpler outcome that you would think, based on her position as a Remain supporter, would align more closely with what she wanted in the first place. And you can say that it's going to be hard for her to sell a soft Brexit deal and to get that through Parliament, but that's a fundamental difficulty of the situation. Any Brexit deal or any outcome is going to be hard to get through Parliament. And any deal that's not hard enough for these high-profile Brexit voters or Brexit politicians who are going to fulminate over how soft it is, if it's not hard enough, then if you're some Labour MP in a pro-Leave seat who's worried about getting voted out, well, you can happily vote that down with your own party because, again, it's not hard enough, and those voters won't punish you for not embracing it. If it is that hard, then there are going to be other people in other parts of your own party and other parties who now won't be able to swallow that pill and vote that through. So anything that happens is going to have to be because of some late break where people don't want to just dive into the unknown, and whatever's on the table, however unpalatable it might seem, is better than the alternative. But it would have been, and I think still will be, much easier if you have a relatively soft Brexit that most people can get behind, both in the country and in various parties, and which nobody is going to want to vote down when, aside from the hardcore Brexiteers, when this dive into the unknown is the alternative.
Okay, so we know your best case timeline is definitely not going to happen. So what are the most realistic looking outcomes here?
Well, let's go back a step to think about what seemed to be on the table at the time. So there were various existing models for other countries which are either in the EU but have a special arrangement, or not in the EU but trade with it and engage with it on special terms, that were seen as good starting points to build around and go from there. So the first one was Norway, which you might think is a fairly small country. Seemed like that would be very different from the UK, and you would be right. But this was seen as a good starting point, if you like, because they're in the single market, so they trade freely with the EU, and there's free movement of people, which is the big sticking point, really. So all of these concerns over immigration and so on come down to this question of, ultimately, if you have free movement, there's nothing you can do about that. That's part of what you signed up for, and that's part of what you have to sign up for if you want to trade on those terms with the EU. That's non-negotiable, and they, as they see it, if they make any concessions there, then that opens the floodgates, and everyone is going to ask for concessions, and the entire principle only works if everybody's willing to put their own short-term selfish interest aside and embrace that idea. So they have free movement, and they have the single market. They don't have a customs union, so those questions of what's going to happen at the border will still arise if you have a Norwegian model in place in the UK. And in theory, there's a legal loophole that allows for these breaks on immigration, but it's never exercised. And it's unclear how the UK would ever qualify to exercise that. So you can point to that and say that leaves you the option. And I imagine if that's what we end up with, that's what the government is going to say to voters who are concerned about immigration, that we have the ability to use this if we need. But realistically, that's not going to be used. Another option you might have is Switzerland, where they're in this free trade area that works with the EU. And they have a ton of very specific, very bespoke deals, which they're not fully happy about. The EU is not fully happy about. And any attempt to replicate Switzerland will be met with a raised eyebrow, both in the UK and in the EU. And that took a lot of time to negotiate, too, and very haphazardly. So using that as a blueprint, I think, is a non-starter. In addition, one of the arguments that was made for Brexit at the time was that you then have a lot more freedom to pick and choose other aspects of various policies, which, by virtue of being in the EU, you have to sign up to and take a certain stance on by default. And with Switzerland, they had a referendum a few years ago on immigration restrictions, which again is a very hot button issue, even if the actual political salience of it is decreasing over time. And the Swiss voters voted to allow certain restrictions, and the EU said, well, that's not free movement, so if you actually try to do that, we're going to punish you. And they tried it, and they were punished. And there was a slap on the wrist. They were expelled from various international agencies and agreements, and there was some compromise worked out over time. But that's an example of how the EU is willing to play hardball on these issues when it needs to. And if you want a much bigger and more high-stakes example of that, just look at what happened in Greece, where, to many people, that was the prototypical example of the EU being inflexible, of bullying smaller countries, of not standing up for the interests of all of its members, and yet they didn't care. They had rules and they stuck to them, and they realized that if they let Greece off the hook, then that gives them no leverage in the future. So they were able to run that into the ground. Or some would say, you know, Greece was a guilty party there by just spending far too much money. But either way, there was no flexibility, because they realized once you show that you're willing to negotiate, well, you now have 27 member states and hundreds of countries outside the EU who are going to want to negotiate on more flexible terms now. So you could say that any hope for a bespoke deal is optimistic to start with, but that's the situation with Switzerland. The other option, which I, as a future honorary Canadian, might be expected to support, is the Canada option, where there has been this free trade deal now in the making for years and years, where they do get this preferential access. What they don't have is passporting rights, where financial firms can act on the same basis they do now in the EU, which, with how finance-centric London is in particular, that's a non-starter. You would want any deal to have some kind of passporting arrangement, or a vast part of what makes the UK's economy so large in the past is going to just have this shaky edifice now. Also, that still hasn't been completed yet. That's been negotiated now for years and years. I think 7 years now in the making, and you're certainly not going to get that in any kind of accelerated pace. You're not going to cram that into the 8 months that we have or whatever before we leave. So that even if you had started with that in mind, you would have had to do some complicated jujitsu to get that in place a lot sooner. And trade deals in general are much more, they're even stodgier, even more complicated, even trickier to negotiate than it sounds like they would be on the surface. And then you have other options which really don't seem like they're that appealing. So like Hong Kong and Singapore, for instance, they both trade on the basic default terms that we would have if we crash out, but there's been some negotiated agreement so that you don't have the same tariffs and everything is a lot more smooth, which you could try to work towards, but again, in the short term, you would have these issues to work through. And then the default, if nothing happens, is you trade on the terms of the World Trade Organization, where currently nobody is doing it. Literally no country in the world does that, because when they reach our status, they then wanted to negotiate their own deal, which they all have done, and we could do that too. But again, there's going to be some period in the middle where everything is kind of in flux, and you would need to have some transition, another transition in place to enable that to happen. So the Chequers deal, which we mentioned, there are very specific things which try to, it's like a magic trick. It's trying to get all of this, they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. They're trying to have a lot of these things in name only, or to have things which sound like they are what we have at the moment, but there's no actual basis for thinking they would be. So before there's any more real commitment to that, before they flesh it out, there's going to be no progress from the EU in terms of conceding anything or publicly accepting that this is what they support and they're willing to agree to.
I personally support the Canada plan. I think Canada gets most things right, and I'm willing to put it out there, Dom. I don't think I've ever put this out on the podcast before. I think Canada at this point in the year 2018, I'm going to say Canada is the number one country in the world.
Wow, that's a kind of patriotic fervor, which is very un-Canadian, Colin. I don't know that they would sign up to that fully. But
I feel like every country should be asking themselves, what can we do to be more like Canada?
There are areas where you might not want to ask that. Like, how do you treat your indigenous population? How do you... quite as simple as that. But yeah, maybe they are a good role model to follow in most things. But the one big issue, which to me means a softer Brexit would be much simpler from the get-go, and which Theresa May hasn't fully given a good answer for yet, is the issue of Ireland. And if you want to understand why that's so important and why that's such a thorny issue and such a heated issue over time, go back and listen to the post-election podcast we did last year with Mike Botter, where I tried at least to explain that in terms that would make sense. But the issue effectively is currently you have the UK, which includes Northern Ireland, and Ireland are both in the EU. So there's no issue there. They're both trading with each other and with other countries on the same terms, and there's no questions asked there. If one of those countries leaves the EU, so let's say the UK, which again includes Northern Ireland, leaves the EU, well, now you have a situation on the country of Ireland where Ireland itself is in the EU, but the part of the country up north in Northern Ireland is not. And so there's going to be questions over, so far there's been easy trade day to day between the two countries. What happens now that one of those countries is in the EU and one of them isn't? Well, the answer is you get border controls. You get the same kind of customs checks and so on that you get between the EU and its border with every other country in the world. And for most of them, that wouldn't be such a big deal. But with Ireland and its incredibly troubled past, and I say troubled with a small t and with a large t there for the people who know the history, then you need to resolve that somehow. And that's not trivial. There are, for instance, roads in the country of Ireland which go back and forth between those two countries multiple times in the space of a few miles. The entire political and economic geography of the country is based around not having that be this elephant in the room in the middle, which you have to drive through or past every single day if you're a lorry driver in Ireland, right? So that's an impossible issue to work out. But there are some alternatives. So you might think, well, what if there is a temporary backstop so that Northern Ireland itself trades with the EU on the same terms while remaining in the UK, and so it's effectively part of the EU for that consideration, but the UK as a whole still gets to leave. Well, you might think that would be okay, but now if the rest of the UK has left, but Northern Ireland is effectively still in, you still have a border that comes up, but it's in the middle of the sea between Ireland and the rest of the UK, and that's not on the table either. when we talk about the Conservative Party, the full name there is the Conservative and Unionist Party. They are fully committed to Northern Ireland being part of the UK, and the Irish Unionists, the Democratic Unionist Party, which we spoke about before, are this fringe whack job group in Ireland, which are having to prop up Theresa May's government now, just so they have a majority in Parliament. That they will not entertain that idea at all. They would sooner quit. They would sooner quit politics altogether than to allow that to happen. So that's not on the table either. So then, what do you do? Do you just have the UK remain in the single market and the customs union? That would be the default option. That would be the simplest plan. That would be the most workable plan. That's what most people wanted the whole time. And yet any move away from that forces you to engage with this question of Ireland, which until that happens, the EU has said, until you have a plan in place for Ireland, nothing further can be negotiated. Until they have a plan in place for Ireland, any deal that they might come up with is dead to rights, basically. Just mathematically, politically, all of it. It can't happen. Logistically, whatever. So that's an issue which only exists because of this desire to chase a hard Brexit, which didn't need to be pursued in the first place. And that's why I say, I think in 2016, it was reasonable to assume, because that issue is the first one that you encounter when you discuss the possibilities for Brexit, then they're going to quickly realize any Brexit that we pursue is going to have to be fairly soft. It's going to match most of what we have at the moment. We're going to stay in the customs union, probably stay in the single market. So regardless of anything else that ends up being haggled over on the side, the core of what we have at the moment is going to remain in place. And yet in their desire to move away from that, they've then come up with this Gordian knot that can't possibly be cut through, and certainly can't be cut through in the next 8 months or so.
Well, at least you guys will get some sweet blue passports out of the deal. But Dom, we've talked a lot about Theresa May, and this may be a symptom of most British prime ministers, but is there any way at the end of the day that she comes out of this looking good?
No, absolutely not. And I think that was always going to be the case anyway. But I mentioned before how there's this just sense of stagnation and decay that sets in whenever the same party has held office for a given length of time. And we're not quite reaching that stage yet with Theresa May, but her own lack of clarity over basically everything, and also the challenges of the situation, have meant that that's been accelerated. That is now that is now imposing on them much sooner than it would for a normal government. And you would think with that, they would be slipping in the polls, they would be 10 points behind, and just marking time until the next election and hoping to minimize the damage. And that kind of is what they're doing to some extent. But I said before that Jeremy Corbyn, there were still lots of doubts around him, and in particular around his approach to Brexit. So with older voters especially, they're not willing to sign on to him, however skeptical they might be at this point about Theresa May. But also, Brexit and the way it's shaped the political landscape have meant that these partisan allegiances have been hardened in place based on what your stance on that is. So by and large, if you support Brexit, you're much more likely to vote Conservative. And if you're Remain, you're much more likely to vote Labour, even though the official stance of the Labour Party at this point isn't fully pro-Remain. So even though the government is going nowhere, and domestically, in foreign policy, in terms of Brexit, there's really no sense of direction. Everything is falling apart. They are still doing pretty well in the polls. So their position has held up quite nicely. So we may be in this spot now where you're not going to have a resounding victory for any one party. And it's going to be this same close sense of deadlock for maybe decades to come now. The alternative, though, is if we do crash out and it does go as badly as the prognosticators say it would, then that is a recipe for a Labour landslide, potentially. That is, if it's complete pandemonium on the streets of the UK, then that, regardless of what the actual causal factors are, that is going to be attributed to the government at the time. They're going to take all the blame for that. So, as we said, it may be in the interest of the Labour leadership officially to scupper a deal, give the public a taste of no deal, and then hope that by the time they get to inherit the some massive majority from the consequences of that, that things have settled down and they now will get to pass on that hot potato before it ends up burning them as well. And so if there's going to be a deal, it might have to come down to Labour MPs who don't support the leadership fully, who are legitimately scared of what a certain type of Brexit might mean, to break ranks en masse and support the government, however unwilling they might be to do that. For Theresa May herself, though, her position might be safer than it ever has been, because for as much as people are talking about her own failings of leadership and whatever difficulties come up with Brexit are going to be blamed on her, it's unclear how exactly they're going to get her out. Because, so I think you would like this, so I'll delve into it quickly. The actual mechanism for challenging a leader in the Conservative Party is very arcane and very convoluted. So what needs to happen is...
A duel?
They're not quite that bad, but there's a committee on the backbenches headed by a guy, Graham Brady, who the way that you want to overturn a leader, the way it has to happen is if, I think it's 15% of the MPs in the party write to him and request a leadership challenge, then one has to happen, and that automatically goes into effect. And if she remains unscathed from that, if she wins, then there's no further challenge for the next 12 months. So it may be in the interest of MPs who support Theresa May to think, well, it's not getting any better from here. We may as well issue that challenge now. And so if she wins, which, and that's in question, but I think she would win and fairly comfortably, if only because there's no other appealing option, then her position is now secure. She has this renewed authority and maybe does not have to worry about the knives edging closer towards her back for at least another year. However,
well, no, hang on. Just quickly on that note, something you touched on earlier that I fully agree with is, I mean, politics is just a game of obtaining power and enacting the policies you want and staying in power. And with that in mind, those people who are considering doing that with Theresa May, do it yesterday. That should already have happened if they recognize this is not going to get better from here, but we want her to stay in.
Right. But what makes all of this much more complicated is that process is anonymous. So if you submit your letter to Graham Brady saying, I want to topple the government, you don't know how many other people are on board at any given time. So I think the total officially for 15% is 48 right now. So you submit, you're disgruntled with Theresa May. You send in your letter. You don't know if there are 46 other letters and it only takes one more to be the tipping point and send you over the line, or if you're out there on your own island and everyone else is remaining in line for now and you're the one letter that's been received. And officially, Graham Brady does not disclose who and how many people have written in to request a challenge, but you can expect that unofficially there are some rumblings and rumors going around about who's written in at what times and so on. And if you, let's say you put in your challenge a year ago, you're actually impressed with the direction things have taken. You think she's turned over a new leaf and you haven't withdrawn your challenge yet. Well, you don't get to like object at the time when the leadership election starts that actually I don't want this anymore. Your letter's there. So you have to choose to withdraw it. But then in doing that, are you giving carte blanche to her to act however she wants? Because like there are these complicated game theory considerations to it, which I think you would enjoy and I would enjoy on this abstract level. But which, in terms of actually running the country and having a sustainable government, maybe are not the best system for it.
Well, this is how she David Cameron's herself, right? This is her calling for the referendum that somehow like leads to her getting overturned. Like, that's the hilarious British political ending to that. So I'm going to remove that strategic advisement that I just issued. I'm going to say, it seems to me like people do too many things just for the lulz, for any move that should be smart to be considered. It seems like the British public or whoever's voting on this sort of thing, the MPs, I suppose, in this situation are like, it's like if you go on Survivor and tell the producers ahead of time, okay, we're going to throw this challenge because that's the smart thing to do. Their new priority is watching you burn.
And it's not as crazy as it might sound for her to trigger an election on herself, because the last Conservative Prime Minister who was bedeviled over Europe back in the 90s did exactly that, and he had to do that to maintain his own authority, because once again, like Theresa May, he had a very slim majority. He had no hope of staggering on with a bunch of mutinous bastards, as he called them, watching his every move. And so he basically told them to put up or shut up, and they did, and he survived, not by a massive margin or anything, but he was able to continue on. And Theresa May might be forced into the same position, so it's there could be fireworks ahead in the near future if that comes to pass. The issue, though,
that sounds exciting. Yeah,
the issue, though, is that it's a two-stage process. So firstly, it goes to the MPs, and then I think it's the two finalists from that are then put to a vote of Conservative members at large. And those people did not have to be elected by a broad swathe of the British public. These are the These are the people who made a conscious choice to sign up to the Conservative Party, for better or for worse. So these are the hardest of hard Brexiteers. These are the people who would genuinely like a return to the 1950s or whatever era they think is more amenable to them. So if it gets to that point, whoever the more extreme candidate is going to win in a landslide. And there's no doubting that whatsoever. So even if you don't like Theresa May, you have an interest in not letting it get to that point unless you are one of those people who, for however loud and boisterous they may be, are a fairly small block in the party. So she knows that she can issue that same threat of put up or shut up, and they will have to shut up because there's really no alternative. And
this is very exciting stuff. I'm going to we should keep an eye on all of this. I didn't know if we were going to be back here anytime relatively soon with updates, but now I am genuinely interested in at least that aspect of it. I could not care less excuse me, whether you stay or leave, but I do love these little strategic angles.
Yeah, so there is a non-zero chance that the Conservative Party and the government as a whole becomes led by the right-wing equivalent of Corbyn and what he means for his own party. And if that's the case, then all bets are off, and there's basically no value predicting anything that could happen anymore, other than it's going to be complete chaos in some way or another.
Yeah, this has been great stuff. What else do we want to get into, if anything, while we're still here?
I don't have anything. I guess as the voice of the people, Colin, what questions do you have that haven't been addressed so far?
No, I think you've been thorough, and thank you, Dom, for being willing to come on. Thanks for being willing to come on your own podcast. No, but thank you for being willing to get into this kind of stuff, because I'm sure plenty of Americans don't care a whole lot about Brexit, but would love some kind of update. And I think I'm hoping at least that plenty of people have enjoyed this as much as I have. I thought this was really informative, and you did a great job talking me through all of this. So thank you very much.
Yeah, I don't know when the next update would be, and hopefully if there is one, it's going to be under better circumstances than we have at the moment, but who knows, honestly. And I'm hoping I will have decamped to Canada before too long, and I will be observing all of this from a distance, and it won't affect me as personally as it does right now. It all remains to be seen on that front.
All right. Awesome. Well, Dom is, of course, on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. You can email us, domandcolin@gmail.com, and let us know if you have ideas for other things, not, you know, specifically Brexit, but other things like this that you would be interested in hearing us talk about along the way, because we're certainly open to mixing in more non-TV or non-movie kind of coverage along the way. So, thank you guys once again for just making it this far into the podcast. I'm sure we'll talk to you very soon. Take care, everybody.